Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, guests, and welcome to the New Books in Israel Studies podcast. I'm your host, Ari Barbalat, and I'm here today with my guest, Rabbi Dr. Aubrey Glaser. We will be discussing his book, Mystical Vertigo, Contemporary Kabbalistic Hebrew Poetry, Dancing Over the Divide, published in 2013 by Academic Studies Press. Aubrey, it's an honor to be in dialogue with you today.
A pleasure, Ari. Thank you for this invitation to explore something that I'm deeply passionate about, and I appreciate your interest in thorough reading.
Thank you. I'm touched to be with you today. To begin, what inspired you to write this book?
My lifelong passion remains Hebrew poetry, and I've always felt, especially when I was doing my doctoral work, but also, even when I was a child, mesmerized by the alphabet of the Aleph all the way to the Tav of the Hebrew letters, I've always been mesmerized by the experience of the words and the letters and how that allows for and opens one to what I've learned is really a mystical experience. And so I've always found that my love of Hebrew poetry has never really been able to be in conversation with my love for Jewish mysticism and Jewish philosophy. So I tried to write humbly a book that I felt was missing on the Jewish bookshelf for all readers. And I hope that I've been able to do that. It feels like I wrote it eons ago, but it's something that's so close to my heart because of the relationship for me to language, one that is so powerful and always alive. I feel like it's something that just emerged in this moment.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Can you kindly tell us about yourself autobiographically?
Sure. My journey is a circuitous one to the place in which I stand. So I'll tell you the short version of the story. And it touches on Hebrew in a few of those places. And I think it's important to share that. When I told my parents I wanted to enter into the rabbinate to become a rabbi, they said to me, "What took you so long?" And that took me backwards and forwards in time, because flashback, when I was in grade 3 in Yeshiva Day School, I encountered the words of the traditional prayer in Hebrew on the page before me, and I had an opportunity to be able to design a cover for my Siddur, my prayer book in Hebrew. And the design along with the letters was something that already in grade 3 said to me that I wanted to do something with this connection with the letters and with the words of prayer and to embody that in some way, and told my parents when I was in grade 3, I want to become a rabbi. And then I forgot about it. Proceeded to forget about it for a number of years. And by the time it came for the celebration of my bar mitzvah, I decided that I wanted to have that in Eretz Yisrael, in the Holy Land. They said, "Where?" "At the Kotel, at the Western Wall." I said, "No, on Masada." And that climb up the snake trail for me was a kind of emblematic excavation of myself that I went through many times afterwards, as Michel Foucault would suggest, we're always going through an archaeology of knowledge. And so that archaeology for me really was implanted on Masada when I was 13. And I went through a series of circuitous routes to get back to that place where I would be able to stand with this sacred language on the sacred land and with the sacred stories of my people. And that led me both through art school, it led me through architecture, it led me to ultimately go into filmmaking, and then to stand at the crossroads and say, should I continue on making films for CBC's Canadian Reflections as I did, or go into the rabbinate? And that was when I decided that the answer was clear. I wanted to go into the rabbinate because I wanted to tell our people's stories. And that sacred act of storytelling for me is something that still remains with me to this day. And it also led me after ordination to come back to my alma mater, the University of Toronto, at the Center for the Study of Religion, and study what is, the topic of this book, that confluence, that bridge over the divide between Jewish mysticism and Hebrew poetry. And so when I completed my PhD, which was my first published book called Contemporary Mystical Hebrew Poetry, this in many ways is an extension of that book. That is to say, Mystical Vertigo is an extension of that first book. And on a nutshell, sort of traveling quickly through space and time, that's part of a major thrust of my story and how it is that I'm writing in this interstitial space between Hebrew poetry and Jewish mysticism, which I call in a fancy way Hebrew hermeneutics. That is to say, what are the ways that Hebrew texts, whether they are traditional liturgy, mysticism, or anything in between, including Hebrew poetry, how do these texts make their meanings evident, and how do you work through meaning making in the text?
In light of what you've alluded to about Hebrew hermeneutics, how does your book contribute to contemporary literary studies and literary theory?
I hope that it not only complicates the narrative, as my friend and colleague Mark Dollinger speaks about in his work in Jewish history and politics, but I hope that it also bumps up the level of sophistication that people expect from the analysis of Hebrew poetry. One of the things that really disturbed me or inspired me, I guess, or awakened me to do this work and to call it hermeneutics, which is a complicated term, is that while I was doing my graduate work in the Center for the Study of Religion, and specifically looking at the philosophy of religion, I was blown away by the level of theoretical sophistication of both German hermeneutics as well as French hermeneutics. And I felt that that was something that already existed or could be uncovered within the study of Hebrew poetry. And in many ways, the unwritten part of this story is that I wanted to be able to create, for better and for worse, a hermeneutical approach to Hebrew that was as sophisticated as and spoke to the issues with the same kind of urgency with which Martin Heidegger, in his German hermeneutics, that really changed the face of 20th century philosophy and poetical studies, the way that he brought his own sophistication to and his lens of reading philosophically the German poetry of Hölderlin, notwithstanding all of the attendant problems of Heidegger's philosophy, which I did not want to inherit, or nor would I justify in terms of his sympathies for and philosophical justification of Nazism. But I felt that the 20th century had gone through a rupture, and that it was really important for Hebrew hermeneutics to emerge from the ashes of Auschwitz. And that was a big part of why I think this does contribute to both the study of Hebrew belles lettres as well as Israel studies.
What assumptions about contemporary Israel does your book challenge?
The assumptions that were being challenged back in 2013, I would have to say are beautifully brought up again for new challenges and new articulations that I probably would have benefited from in the recent book of Micha Goodman called The Wandering Jew in English. And there, what he does in 2021 is something I was trying to do in 2013, but didn't necessarily have all the language for at my disposal. And what I was really trying to challenge and to do was, first of all, to challenge Israeli identity. And the book behind the book that I wrote is also an exploration really of one term in Jewish mysticism, maybe two. And I was challenging the assumptions that you have to be a scholar of Jewish mysticism to appreciate the cultural relevance, both in terms of religiosity and Zionism, of terms that come from Jewish mysticism, that they're somehow divorced from discussions we have about Israeli identity. I've always been moved and impressed by the speed, the acceleration at which not only Hebrew language evolves, but the cultural resonances of the most ancient concepts and experiences within Hebrew poetry and Jewish mysticism are constantly emerging and re-emerging, as Gershom Scholem remarked in that 1926 letter to Franz Rosenzweig, like a volcano. And the Hebrew language itself is like a volcano. And what I'm interested in doing this work is, as I mentioned, the book behind the book is really an examination of two terms and how to render them into English philosophical language. And the first term is the title of the book, Mystical Vertigo. And that was my way, through the lens of French philosopher Alain Badiou, of trying to determine a way of translating with the same kind of sophistication that I was seeing and experiencing in the Jewish mystical texts, specifically of the medieval text called the Zohar, a term that that spoke of mati velo mati, that is to say, in Aramaic, touching but not touching, grasping but not grasping. And what was induced by this experience of the mystic is something that I came up with after reading a lot of Badiou and a lot of Zohar, was this sense of mystical vertigo, that somehow both the reader as well as the poet and the seeker, when they deeply immerse themselves in this hermeneutical experience of making meaning of a text, they experience, the mystical experience is one of vertigo, of touching but not touching, of grasping but not grasping, and it induces that kind of experience. And that was something that for me was important. So that's one term that I wanted to explore. And the other term was dvekut, which is really a kind of cleaving, emerging, a sense of unio mystico. All those terms that we banty about in English translation are very difficult in terms of being able to have the exactitude of actually capturing what goes on within the Hebrew. So if I was to summarize what the goal of the book behind the book was, it was really to render in English for an Anglophone audience what is the operative poetics of two terms, namely mati velo mati, grasping but not grasping, mystical vertigo, and dvekut, which is that mystical experience of merging.
How did you choose the selected poets and authors that show up in the book? And did you meet any of them personally?
Well, every one of the poets, except for Avraham Ben Yitzchak, who was predeceased, are all living and writing poetry in Eretz Yisrael, as well as, I apologize, Zelda Schneerson-Mishkovsky, also predeceased. Aside from that, Chaviva Pedaya, Yonadav Kaplun, Tamar Elad Applebaum, Binyamin Shvili, Chaya Esther, Shai Tubali, Shulamit Chava Halevi, Agi Mishol are all living and writing in Eretz Yisrael, and 90% of them, I either met in person or have relationships with them. And it was an extension of my doctoral work, which thanks to the generosity of the Bronfman Foundation, when I was a doctoral student, I actually was able, through their a research grant, to go to spend extended time in Eretz Yisrael working with and researching the first book that I did and some of the leftover research that I was able to apply in my selection of the poets and their poetry here in the act of researching and being in conversation with them, which obviously is on the one hand exciting, and on the other hand, from the, from an academic perspective, when I told my advisor, the proposed advisor that I was pursuing, that I wanted to actually be able to study these living poets, he said to me, they have to be dead for 50 years. So I did get a chance to, as I said, to meet and to speak with all of them, except for Zelda, who I always dream about, and perhaps meet in the world of poetry beyond this world, as well as Avraham Ben Yitzchak, who to me are two outstanding and very underappreciated Hebrew poets that are also featured in this book.
You alluded to Zelda, referring to Zelda Schneerson Mishovsky, and you have a chapter on her in the book. What's the significance of her work, in particular her poem On That Night? Can you elaborate who she is for some of our readers and listeners?
Sure. She's just so remarkable. I mean, the thing that's so interesting is if you talk to Israelis and you look through, you know, the bookshelf in any, almost any Israeli's home over the past few decades, I would say, you know, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to find a copy of Zelda's poetry. And the fact that she's only known by her first name, that's all that it takes to be able to refer to her, on a certain level, it alludes to her fame within Israel. In the same way that Bialik was only known by his last name, or Amichai, there are the certain poets that are just known by their shorthand. So Zelda was really part and parcel of everyone from someone who was driving a bus to, you know, a soldier to someone who was working, a teller at a bank. Anybody and everybody really knew Zelda's poetry and loved it, because it spoke to the soul of what it means to be a human being and to be a seeker, and to do that in this inimitable language that she was able to bring to the Israeli and Hebrew speaking public in a way that I think is really, really second to none. And part of what drew me to her, and in many ways I would hope to be able to return to her work, and maybe this will be part of my next book when I get back to doing more work on Hebrew hermeneutics. I really feel like she's very, very underappreciated. And part of what I was mentioning that really draws me to her is this very interesting hybrid identity that she also represents. I was looking at hybrid identity in the opening chapter through the lens of a great Hasidic master living in Eretz Yisrael named the Yama Chochma, Itchy Meir Morgenstern. And he doesn't write poetry, but his work is very poetic. Zelda writes poetry, or wrote poetry, and it was extremely mystical. And though she lived from 1914 and made Aliyah early on and passed away in 1992, being born in Russia and passing away in Yerushalayim, she also came with a really fascinating lineage. She was born in the city of Yekalstrinolav to the renowned lineage of Shlomo Shalom and Rachel Schneerson. So her father was the great-grandson of the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, known as the Semach Tzedek, and her mother descended from the great Sephardic dynasty of Chen Gracian, and traces its roots back to the 11th century in Barcelona, where her maternal grandfather's grandfather was Rabbi Elchanan ben Meir, who was a student of great lineage as well. So this interesting hybridity between having deep Sephardic roots in the mystical tradition, as well as roots within the great Chabad lineage, I think positioned her to really feel at home in mystical experience and being able to convey that in just an incredibly remarkable way. So she's one of a kind. I strongly recommend the bilingual edition of Marcia Falk's translation and commentary to Zelda's poetry, selections of it from her oeuvre called Spectacular Difference. It's a good place to start, but there's much, much more work to be done on the luminous legacy of Zelda.
Thank you for sharing that. Another poet I'd be curious to ask you about is Chaviva Pitaya. Mm-hmm. Why is she popular with the Israeli novelist Amos Oz and with musicians in Israel such as Meir Banai and Barry Sakharov? Can you describe her work for us and some of her poetry for us?
Yes, she's also a remarkable living legend. I would say if anyone within this collection is sort of carrying forward the deep influence within Israel and specifically within the evolution of Hebrew culture as a mystical experience, it must be Chaviva. And Chaviva is astonishing because she's the great-granddaughter of Yehuda Fetaya, who is a great Iraqi mystic that made Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael in the early part of the 20th century. And she kind of carries forward his visionary work. What's interesting about Fetaya is not only that he came from this mystical tradition of the great Iraqi Makubalim, who were very concerned with dream interpretation and visions. So she inherited that predilection from him, but he also wrote piyut. It was very common to write liturgical poetry, as well as him writing very extensive commentaries on the mystical tradition of Lurianic Kabbalah. So she comes from this fascinating kind of lineage, and she also teaches at the Ben-Gurion University in Be'er Sheva in the Department of Sephardic Studies and Jewish History. And she recently won the Gershom Sholem Prize in Kabbalah. So she is renowned within Israel as a towering force of Jewish philosophy and specifically the Sephardic tradition, but is interested in reaching out beyond the binaries of Chiloni and Dati, which have for a long time not really applied in Israel. That is to say, someone is avowedly secular or avowedly religious. Those terms are part of that hybrid identity that I problematize in the book, and I referred to earlier relative to Micha Goodman's typologies of the Israeli and the wandering Jew. Chaviva really exemplifies that, and the fact that she is so appealing to, and so much of her music, so much of her poetry has been set to music by Barry Sakharov and Meir Banai and others, as well as being appreciated by the grand authors of Israel, like Amos Oz, they understand that the work that she's writing is visionary on a whole other level than many of the poets that are her contemporaries. So the fact that, and she's also involved in a project called Yonat Rechokim. Her brother is a chazan in the Judeo-Iraqi tradition, and she is the musical advisor and in a sense the one who's the expert in piyut, who advises this group of the repertoire that they're singing. So it comes from both the ancient piyut background, liturgical poetry, which was very much part and parcel of the Sephardic and Mizrahi lineage that she comes from, but it also speaks to the Israeli hit parade and the radio in a way that that I think really parallels the kind of massive appeal that Zelda also had in her time.
In light of boundary crossing poets, another I'd like to ask you about is Shulamit Chava Halevi. You devote significant attention to her poems, The 15th of Milopotamos and mm-hmm. Strange Fire. Can you tell us about her poetry?
Shulamit is also a remarkable, remarkable poet and brings to bear her own kind of mystical vision. I was introduced to her work actually when I was in Yerushalayim. My friend and advisor, Menachem Tzvi Fox, who teaches at the University of Toronto and advised the bulk of my dissertation in this Hebrew poetry, also introduced me to many of the poets that I have had the blessing and the honor of being able to research and to be in conversation with. So as it stands, the legend goes, Shulamit Chava Halevi was introduced to me by Tzvi at an annual Tuba Av love poetry slam that he would have in his flat in Yerushalayim. So Tuba Av, known as the 15th of Av, It's kind of like Jewish Sadie Hawkins Day. It's described in the Mishnah called Tractate Tanit, and it speaks about the choreography of the daughters of Jerusalem and the sons of Israel going out into the fields and having a kind of mating ceremony where they would dance and intermingle and eventually find their partner. And so what's emerged in Israel is this interesting kind of unofficial tradition. Not only is it Jewish Sadie Hawkins Day where you're looking for your partner, but he introduced this this great custom of actually getting together with people and reading love poetry. So it was like a love poetry slam. And anyways, he, because of his connections with all these poets in Yerushalayim, he happened to invite Shulamit to come to this particular reading. And of the many, many poems that I could have chosen, Tu Ba'ab Melipotamus is fascinating, as is Strange Fire. And what I find so fascinating about Shulamit's poetry is the not only the texture of the mystical visioning that she's able to capture in her mellifluous Hebrew, but also the juxtaposition of different experiences. Specifically, Strange Fire deals a lot with the experience of Maranos, or the Anusim, as she would prefer that they would be called, rather than Maranos, because it's more of a derogatory term for those converso Jews who were forced to convert to Christianity on the outside but remained secret Jews on the inside. Strange Fire is a really, really interesting way into the life of someone who was an Anus, someone who was compelled to have this hybrid identity. And Tu Ba'ab Melipotamus is another one of her love poems in the far-off Grecian islands. And I love the juxtaposition of the Greek and the Hebrew, as well as with the Murano and the Anus experience, Jewish Christian. I think she does some remarkable things that are, again, complicating the narrative relating to Hebrew culture and Israeli identity.
I would be curious to ask you about the poetry project that you write about in chapter 9, Return the Spirit. Can you contextualize this poetry project for us, especially as it provides the background for the poetry of Tamar Elad Applebaum? Can you speak to this project and how this project contextualizes her poetry?
So Return the Spirit is a loose translation of a journal, but also kind of a gathering and ongoing workshop that's supported by the Israeli government through the Minister of Sport and Culture. And it's called Mashiv HaRuach. So Mashiv HaRuach is both the name of the project. It's also the name of the annual journal. It's the name of the workshops that bring all these poets together. And if memory serves me, I believe Elchanan Nir and some other great poets who I have not included in this collection were responsible for bringing that group together. And it just so happens that Tamar Elad Applebaum is one of the, I think, one of the foremost poets who is part of this collective, and has appeared in many of the Mashiv HaRuach journals and the workshops. And she also happens to be a profound young voice of prophetic poetry that is emerging, again, within this hybrid space of not being quite Chiloni, not being quite Dati Leumi, in terms of the work that she's doing with the Rabbanut Yisraelit. But really, from my recollection, I think it was established in the early 90s, and there's always been a rotating editorial board. But now I recall, I think it was actually, it originated with Shmuel Klein, with Yoram Nissanovich, Nachum Pechnik, and Elias Cohen was the other poet that I was thinking of. And they are a remarkably robust group of, primarily, they wouldn't call themselves Dati Leumi or Chiloni. That is to say, they're not national religious, nor are they secular, but there's a new hybrid term that's emerged that I learned by immersing myself in the decades-long project of Mashiv HaRuach in their annual journal. They like to see themselves as emunati. That is to say, there's something like spiritualist poets would be the best translation that I could give to it. And I think that really points to something fascinating that really has captured and continues to captivate my attention that's going on throughout this entire book, as well as my first book, as well as within the pages of Mashiv HaRuach, and really every Elul, when there is a new release of a surge of Hebrew poetry on the market, because the Hebrew speaking audience and the readership in Israel has a voracious appetite for new Hebrew poetry and culture. And Mashiv HaRuach is really one of the great waves within that surge, that oceanic surge of creativity that is constantly flowing, ebbing and flowing within Israel.
Your book devotes tremendous attention to literary theory, both literary theory drawn out of the mystical poets you describe, as well as the contribution of hermeneutical theory to understanding many of the poets presented. For example, you allude to Homi Bhabha's concept of dissemination, with the N midway through dissemination being capitalized. How is the concept of dissemination relevant to thinking about Israeli mystical poetry? In particular, what connection does it bear to the poetry of Agi Mishol and her poems Shahida and Transistor Muezzin?
So what's interesting about these kinds of juxtapositions that I was creating is I was also kind of imagining a conversation between these different theorists. Homi Bhabha really, in many ways, is an incredibly important post-colonial theorist. And I can't really imagine ever having a conversation with a Hebrew poet. So I intentionally created a series of juxtapositions and kind of wanted to imagine a kind of what I would call curating curious conversations over coffee, because I had so many great conversations with these Hebrew poets over coffee in the Beit Cafe in my time in Eretz Yisrael. So I wanted to kind of create these different juxtapositions that would not in any way be normative or expected, somewhat surprising. And so I can tell by your question that you were obviously surprised by it. Now, dissemination is something that's interesting in the English language. You can't really do in Hebrew. In Hebrew, you have all these different ways of being able to create what are kind of known as collocations of the letters, like mixing up and permutating the letters. It's called tziruf otiyot. And that's sort of natural in Hebrew, but you can't make capital and lowercase, right? You really just have, it just depends what script you're using, but it's always, everything is capitalized, so to speak. But what Bhabha does that I think is really interesting is that he plays with tziruf otiyot, and the word dissemination then also has a capital N with nation. And what he's interested in there, from a critical perspective, is the approach of and the understanding of how time and narrative affect the margins of the modern nation. I believe that article that became a book he wrote in the 90s. And of course, he owes the tip of the hat to Jacques Derrida, who is an Algerian Jew whose modes of hermeneutical interpretation have deeply inspired the work that I'm doing. And in many ways, when Bhabha was writing Dissemination, he tips his hat to Derrida, but also says that his understanding of the nation of time and of his own narrative, his own space within that process of understanding where he fits in or does not fit into the nation that he's a part of, the nation state that he's a part of, is a function of migration and exile. And I think that a lot of what is really interesting and delicious and challenging and provocative, both in the book as well as within Hebrew culture writ large, is the place that the Hebrew poet occupies or hovers or sits or stands in, depending on the specific moment, and whether the poet is like the prophet, that really in many ways stands at the margin of the modern nation state and is called upon to be able to bring these sacred words that come from the ancient depths, that volcano that I was speaking about earlier, that whenever a word in Hebrew is used in Lashon HaKodesh, it resonates with all of the layers of accretion through space and through time. And what Baba is trying to recover in his own way, I think is already happening within the complexities of Hebrew language itself. Now, you could say, you know, Aubrey, why didn't you just choose, for example, to look at the essay, the 1919 essay, I believe, by Chaim Nachman Bialik, called Gilui V'Kisui B'Lashon. Probably one of the most brilliant, underappreciated essays, which means revealed and concealed in language. The argument could be made that everything I wanted to do on this project of Hebrew hermeneutics is already contained in Bialik's essay from 1919. And I think that probably that's true. I wanted to complicate the narrative, and for whatever reason, I guess because, you know, the story I told you earlier, when I was in Kita Gimel in grade 3 through grade 7, I was studying Bialik. I always felt that even though Bialik's approach to poetry and his renown is second to none, that on a certain level, theorists don't take his work seriously enough outside of the Jewish world of Hebrew belles-lettres, and I wanted to go from the outside in and to say, I'm going to look at these theorists, including someone who's a post-colonial theorist, like Homi Bhabha, and bring him back into conversation with Israel studies and with Hebrew poetry to create a more sophisticated and complex and current form of Hebrew hermeneutics. But the more that I look back at Bialik's essay from 1919 of Gilui B'Kisui B'Lashon, I wonder whether it's time to return to uncover that genius, maybe to bring him into conversation with Homi Bhabha. I mean, I love these surreal kind of curious conversations. And so it's a long answer to a very important question, but that to me feels a lot of the reason why I went in that direction. And Agi Mishal is a whole other story. I can respond to that if you wish as well, but she's considered by Dan Meron in the preface to Kol Kitvei Agi Mishal, she is considered to be a prolific poet in her own right at this time. The poems of hers that I chose to include within my collection were also very strategically chosen, specifically because of the provocative content and the fact that those poems, to my recollection, were first published within the what's called the Musaf, the supplementary edition to the weekend Shabbat paper. So Shahida and Transistor Muazzin were both featured at certain times within the daily paper. And I think that's, again, something that we need to appreciate that is not happening at the same level within the Anglophone world. I do realize that there are some supplements on the weekends in different papers across the world in English papers where there are poets from time to time who may contribute something. But this is a regular thing that Hebrew readers expect within all of the dailies. So whether it's in Haaretz, whether it's in Mariv, or whether it's in even Makor Rishon, there's so many different papers that are available to a reader on Shabbat in Israel. And when you get to the extra edition, sort of like the supplement, there's always an expectation that there's going to be something in there that is new and fresh that comes from the plethora of Hebrew poets. So the Shahida poem, Woman Martyr, was actually published after a bombing in a bakery in Bethlehem. And you can just begin to try to imagine the collective trauma that is going on within the culture at that time, and then for the poet to have the unmitigated audacity to come out so soon after the bombing. And there were a spate of bombings that were going on incessantly during the time where she was writing this, where Agi has the, again, as I said, this kind of audacity to bring out her poetic vision, which is so difficult to imagine, but the poetic voice actually tries to imagine what it must be like to be inside the mind with many screws loose of a bomber, Andalib Takatata, who was one of the many bombers who destroyed and took lives as a homicide bomber in Israel during this time. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it took place during a rush to the bakery, and it was a poem that that really shocked the Israeli public, and I think that there's something there that is worth reflecting on. Why is it that a culture and a democracy within the Middle East is willing to publish a provocative poem in Hebrew? Mehran calls her the comic Sibyl, right? So in a sense, she is both dealing with comedy and tragedy in one fell swoop with great dark humor. And she's willing to look at, with biting irony at this experience while the nation is healing, to readers of Haaretz as they mull over the literary supplement over the Sabbath, what is going on inside the mind of a Shahida.
Fascinating. Another hermeneutical concept that emerges in your book shows up in chapter 2 when you make reference to the concept of integral divinity. For example, you have a passage on page 79, in traversing structural stages in the evolution of consciousness from Eloheinu to integral divinity, the degree to which each wave is a critical part of all subsequent waves becomes clearer. Poetry is one of the greatest modes of attunement to this interiority. What do you mean by the evolution from Eloheinu to integral divinity? What is integral divinity in the context of your work?
Well, it's something that I was trying to play with in the same way that we saw in English that Homi Bhabha was playing with letters, all caps and lowercase, with dissemination. Here, what I wanted to do was to claim and to adapt integral thinking and integral philosophy of Jean Gebser into conversations about monistic and monotheistic spiritual traditions like Judaism. And part of what I'm suggesting is that the ancient theomorphic term for God known as El, which is an ancient name for the one enwrapped in mystery, eventually becomes known as Eloheinu, right? So it becomes part of a larger, more expansive tribal understanding of the word God for the Israelite tribe. And then it becomes ours. And so it becomes a tribal expression of a particularistic approach to divinity. And what I'm trying to suggest is that there are a different series of kind of stages of evolution in terms of how we understand God in that structure when taken through the lens of integral thinking. And so again, it's another strange conversation, a curious conversation that I wanted to be able to curate. And it really suggests there's an evolution of consciousness and that there are different stages in the evolution of God. And that is something that has been explored, for example, in process theology. Lisa Wortsman has written about that and others as well. But there's a sense in terms of what John Gebser is referring to, that there is a constant process of this evolution of consciousness. And what I wanted to do is to move from the mental to the integral. That is to say, we don't just think about God, but we actually integrate the experience of the divine into our lives as a hermeneutical act. And what happens then is as that integration process begins to happen, I switched and played with the way that the word integral is written in English. For the viewers, just to imagine, it's normally spelled capital I and then N-T-E-G-R-A-L. And what you alluded to is that I switched that and played with it in a permutated way and replaced the AL with the capital EL, referring back to the Hebrew nomination for the divine. And what I'm trying to point to through this play in language is that there is within Hebrew poetry, specifically in Admiel Kozman's work, as well as within Avraham Ben Yitzchak that I refer to in that chapter, there is this process of the evolution of consciousness, and it's a dissolution of the tension or the dialectic between the ego or world immanence and the experience of the transcendent, which is really symbolized by the experience of El.
Along these lines, another hermeneutical concept that you pay attention to in your book shows up in chapter 6. Specifically, what I'm alluding to is the term touching crossed out in strike through. Mm-hmm. For example, on page 153, when you describe the work of the poet Shai Tuvali, you write as follows: the immediacy of touching presented as it regularly is, wading through, touching, crossed out with strike through, still quivers for intimacy. You go on to say, it is through such touching, and here touching again is crossed out with strike through, that the God quivering for intimacy can once again be redeemed through mystical vertigo. What is the concept of touching crossed out in a strike through? And can you explain why you present touching in that way?
Yeah, it's a great question. And again, it's a way of trying to play with the way that the words appear on the page in English as opposed to the playfulness that's going on within the Hebrew. So I mentioned earlier, the book behind this book is really related to two terms, and they come to a head right here, especially in Shai Tubali's poetry, in these poems that I present, relating to the term mati velo mati, which means touching but not touching. So in a sense, if you want to try to write that down in one word, instead of writing touching but not touching in four words, Jacques Derrida speaks about this erasure in language that's possible. And it's possible to actually be able to strike the word out, but for it to be there and to not be there at the same time. How do you convey that? So I created this touching with the strike through, which is really an English rendering of mati velo mati, touching but not touching, in the mystical terminology of the Zohar in Aramaic. And part of what is emerging that you're also touching on here, no pun intended, is the kind of paradoxical tension that I begin to play with, especially in Tubali's poetry, but it's throughout the entire book, in the sense that if we talk about the experience of Dvekut, which is an experience of, in a sense, non-dual consciousness or merging, where there's no longer a subject and an object, or even two subjects, then what does that mean in terms of the poet's relationship to God and the experience, as we spoke of El, or whatever it is that we attribute as a name for God, or for the experience of the infinite and the transcendent? What does that look like in terms of language, and how does the mystic, and in this case the Hebrew poet, convey that in a form of language that can actually be read and understood in some kind of a cogent way?
How does your book's insight into Hebrew and Israeli poetry contribute to the study of Kabbalah as an intellectual academic discipline?
My hope is that readers within Hebrew studies and Israel studies will be piqued enough by the references to Kabbalah, to Jewish mysticism, to go deeper into the original sources, and vice versa. My hope is that those who are schooled in the academic study of, as well as the practice of Kabbalah, of Jewish mysticism, which really, interestingly enough, was created as a discipline at the Hebrew University when Gershom Scholem came to found the critical study of Kabbalah as a discipline there. So it's no mistake that Hebrew culture and its evolution happens in Eretz Yisrael. What I'm hoping is that the interest will cross-fertilize conversations that don't happen often enough. Scholem himself was a poet, but he was a poet in the closet, and he didn't write poetry in Hebrew. He wrote his poetry in German. There were other academic scholars of Kabbalah back pre-state who also wrote poetry, but most of them didn't write it in Hebrew. They wrote it in their native tongue in terms of where they emigrated from. Isaiah Tishbe, I believe, wrote poetry in Hungarian, and Joseph Weiss likely wrote his poetry, I believe, in English. So there were all these great scholars of Kabbalah at the beginning of the 20th century, either being trained by Scholem or living in the land of Israel and then going off into the diaspora to teach and to do work, but they were never really in serious conversation with poetry. And I want there to be a serious conversation between those two disciplines. And I feel like that's something that's emerging in our own time, in our own day and age. I think also of the plethora and the richness of mystical poetry being written today. For example, Eitan Fishbane's new book called Embers of Pilgrimage is an experiment in the English language of trying to render some of these deep concepts in the Hebrew and the Aramaic into a cogent and coherent language of mystical poesis in the English, which I think he very successfully and creatively does. And there are a handful of other poets who are doing that work. So what was not happening already, even in 2013, with as much frequency as I had hoped, is already beginning to emerge in a more prolific and fertile way.
As we bring this interview to a close, I wanted to convey my gratitude to you for your time and for the erudition that went into this book. The final question I'd like to ask you is, what are you working on now? Can you elucidate us on your current research as it's presently unfolding?
Sure, I would love to, Ari. And I also want to thank you for your very close reading of a book that's very, very dear to my heart. I really appreciate your thoughtful questions. I can tell you long-term and short-term what I'm working on. I'm involved in a decades-long project in the excavation of a fascinating modern mystical community in Tiberias. And I'm working on the third of seven volumes of the writings and the teachings and the practices of this mystical confraternity in Tiberias that was headed by Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk and Avraham HaKohen of Kalisk. It's called From Tiberias with Love. And so I'm now working on the Igrot Kodesh, the letters that they wrote back and forth in Hebrew, in the mellifluous Hebrew, to their disciples and colleagues in Eastern Europe from Tiberias, where they settled in to make their home in the Jewish homeland in 1777. So that's an ongoing project that I'm going to continue to work on, that's I'm deeply immersed in. And more shorter term, it's very likely that I'm going to return to write a sequel to my last book on Leonard Cohen that was called Tangle of Matter and Ghost, and probably create a curious conversation between Leonard Cohen, a blessed memory, and Bob Dylan, and maybe Lou Reed on death and dying practices. I'm very interested in the question of how English poetical lyrics within contemporary music speaks to the deeper urgent questions of our own mortality. I'm also interested in that on the Hebrew side, so there'll probably be a companion volume in terms of the great Hebrew poets that I love that will speak to that question. But right now I seem to be drawn back into this ongoing conversation between Leonard Cohen and Bob Dylan. So we'll see what emerges, but those are some of the things that are on my writing desk right now.
Thank you. What a busy guy. Thank you. I appreciate the time you devoted to developing such a remarkable, insightful, creative, and impressive book in Mystical Vertigo. And I'm also extremely grateful for the time you took to talk to me and to our listeners on the New Books in Israel Studies podcast. Thank you.
My pleasure, Ari, and all my best wishes to you and to the great work you're doing for the podcast. And I hope that the listeners get to expand their horizons. And if you have an opportunity to get a copy of the book, I'm sure you'll find it a provocative read. Thank you.
Thank you. To our listeners, this has been Aubrey Glaser, the author of Mystical Vertigo, Contemporary Kabbalistic Poetry, Dancing Over the Divide, published in 2013 by Academic Studies Press. I'm your host, Ari Barbalat, with the New Books in Israel Studies podcast. Thank you for your attention. Thank you.